In this lecture, I want to draw on the problem-solving strategy of visualization, the problem-solving strategy of simplification, the problem-solving strategy of thought experiments. We've worked with all of those before. I want to bring them together in order to apply them to the kind of if-then connections we talked about with regard to scientific experimentation. There is a conceptual tool that incorporates all of these. It has a long and distinguished history. But with the advent of computers, I expect it to have an even more important future. This lecture is about thinking with models, all kinds of models. I'll start with an example drawn from the work of the economist and political scientist Thomas C. Schelling. This is Schelling's segregation model, one of the contributions for which he received the Nobel Prize in 2005. Schelling was as familiar as the rest of us with the de facto residential segregation characteristic of American cities and suburbs. If you look around your neighborhood, it's unlikely that you'll find a statistical cross-section of racial and ethnic groups. Are 15% of your neighbors Latino? 13% African American? 4% Asian American? 1% Native American? 67% white non-Latino? Probably not. Ethnicity maps of American cities typically show white areas, African American areas, Latino and Asian areas. Schelling's question was this: what does that say about racism? Do those ethnicity maps show that we're all more racist than we'd like to think? Schelling decided to construct a little model to help him think that question through. He drew a checkerboard grid on a piece of paper. Just a lot of squares. He reached into his pocket for change and used dimes and pennies to represent two ethnic groups. He distributed those randomly across the checkerboard, making sure to leave some empty spaces. I encourage you to try this yourself. The dimes and pennies were the agents in his model. The checkerboard was an abstract model for residential space, where those agents lived. In an initial random distribution, pennies and dimes would have been pretty evenly distributed. What Schelling thought of as the neighbors of a penny, or a dime, were those in the immediate squares around it. The neighborhood for any square are those 8 squares touching it on each side and on the diagonals. Schelling then gave his pennies and dimes some low-level preferences. The dimes weren't racist. They did want to live in a neighborhood where a third of the people around them were of the same ethnicity. But they were perfectly happy to have two-thirds of their neighbors different. The same was true of the pennies. Two-thirds unlike them, fine. But they would like at least a third of their neighbors to share their background. He picked a random penny or dime. It would have some other pennies or dimes in the immediate neighborhood around it. If at least a third of those were of its kind, then it could stay where it was. If it had less than a third of its own kind around them, it would move to a random empty space. So we have a random distribution. Nobody is particularly racist, but they do want at least a third of their neighbors to be like them, and they'll move if they don't. What happens as we play those preferences out? Even with those low preference levels, distributions on the board start to form little neighborhoods. They're little patches that are mostly all dimes. It starts to look a lot like the residential segregation characteristic of American cities and suburbs. Much of contemporary computer modeling is just an extension of that kind of thinking. Here's a computer simulation, a computer instantiation of Schelling's model, just larger and done by a computer rather than by hand. The same low-level preferences on the part of agents, the same resultant pattern of de facto residential segregation. Schelling's is a great example of what I mean by a model. In the original, there with dimes and pennies on a hand-drawn checkerboard, he was thinking with a model. In a sense, thinking through a model. Let me emphasize some of the important characteristics of that case. The first is that Schelling didn't just think it through in his head. He manipulated pennies and dimes on a hand-drawn checkerboard. We've seen that lesson before. Thinking doesn't have to all be in your head. Thinking shouldn't be confined to the dark and lonely recesses of your skull. Thinking is something you can do with your eyes. That's the strategy of visualization. We have amazing abilities of pattern recognition, instant, detailed, and accurate. It would be a shame not to use those abilities in thinking. If we can convert an abstract problem into a picture, something we can see, we can often think it through much more effectively. That's how Pythagoras may himself have thought through the Pythagorean theorem, thinking visually. Pythagoras may actually have manipulated tiles. Look at that. Sure enough, the area of the square on the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares on the other two sides. Pythagoras may have thought the theorem through using a model. Pythagoras may have been thinking with his hands, just like Schelling with his pennies and dimes. In order to think, you don't have to strike a pose like Rodin's thinker. Indeed, that's probably not the most effective thinking pose. I'll bet Rodin himself didn't strike that pose when he thought about his sculpture. It's in fact very likely that he thought it through with a piece of clay. He thought it through with his hands. It's very likely that Rodin thought the sculpture through by using a model. Thinking is often most effective when you recruit your eyes to the task. Thinking is often most effective when you can manipulate things with your hands. Both of those show up in thinking with models. A second and obvious characteristic of Schelling's model is that it uses the strategy of simplification. What he's out to understand is something very complicated: social patterns of housing by ethnicity. Those patterns are the result of innumerable, careful, and complex decisions by thousands of interacting individuals. We know those individuals are influenced in their decisions by employment patterns, demographics, the complexities of housing availability, mortgage practices, individual finances, and life histories. Schelling's model includes none of that detail. It doesn't even really have individuals who belong to ethnic groups, just pennies and dimes. It includes no real representation that's anything like a map of any city, just a checkerboard drawn on a piece of paper. Do you remember the Tower of Hanoi problem? You have three posts in a row. The middle and right posts are empty. On the left post are stacked a series of six disks, ordered from largest at the bottom to smallest at the top. Your task is to end up with all six disks in the same order, but on one of the other two poles. You can only move one disk at a time. You can only move a disk from one pole to another. And you can never put a larger disk on top of a smaller one. What is the least number of moves in which you can get all six disks in order from one post to another? An important strategy for that kind of problem was simplification. If you want to know how to do it with six disks, start with just two. That'll give you a basic understanding of a pattern of moves required to solve the more complicated problem. Move the top small disk to one pole, then the one under it to another, and move the small disk on top. For three disks, you can do the same thing for the top two, then move the third disk to another pole and repeat the original dance with the two smaller disks. Seven moves. By the time you get up to six disks, that compounds to 63 moves. Schelling wants to understand something much more complicated than that, and much more real than the Tower of Hanoi problem. He wants to understand why residential segregation might happen with real people in real cities. That makes the simplification of his model far more outrageous than the Tower of Hanoi with just two disks, but the strategy is the same. Try to understand something complicated by understanding something related, but much simpler. Now let's look at the structure of Schelling's thinking. The model works with an input and generates an output. It goes from input to output by way of what I'll call the mechanism. Three steps: input, mechanism, and output. The input is the original random distribution of pennies and dimes. The mechanism here is embodied in Schelling's rules. Pick a penny or dime at random. If at least a third of its neighbors are like it, it stays. If not, it moves. The output of the model is the final arrangement of pennies and dimes, segregated patches. This is where the link to the if-then structure of experiments comes in. What the model explores is what happens if. What happens if we start with a random distribution and a one-third preference rule? What Schilling's model shows is that residential segregation could occur even without any blatant racism. None of our dimes or pennies hates the other kind. There are no pennies that move out just because a dime moves into the neighborhood. All any of them want is to have some of their own kind around. Not even half, just one-third. Models often have that three-stage structure: input, mechanism, and output. But there are lots of different purposes to which models are put, and that three-stage structure is used in lots of different ways. That's important both for your own thinking with models and for evaluating the use of models by others. Here's the basic picture. We build a three-stage model, but are really only confident of two of those stages. We use the model to tell us about the third stage. On the basis of two pieces of information we have, we use the three-stage model to give us the third piece of information we don't have, the missing piece of the puzzle. Prediction uses what we know at two stages to get new information about the future. Retrodiction uses two different stages to give us information about the past. Explanation uses the three stages in a still different way. But in each case, we build in what we know at two stages of a three-stage model and read off the information we need at the third. Let's start with prediction. Our three-stage model consists of input, mechanism, and output. In prediction, we have some confidence in our input conditions. We also think we understand our mechanism. Our model uses input and mechanism to generate an output, and that output is what we take as the model prediction. Weather prediction uses models precisely this way. We know what the weather readings are across the United States today. We know what they've been for the past week. Those are our input conditions. Over decades, we've developed certain principles that we think apply to the weather. We know what happens when a dry, cold front meets a wet, warm front. We know something about wind and the dynamics of the atmosphere. We know something about how the Rocky Mountains and the Great Plains enter the picture. All those are part of the mechanism of our models. These days, the models for weather forecasting are instantiated as computer programs. The MM5 is a fifth-generation model at Penn State. The Weather Research Forecasting Model is billed as the next generation, backed by the National Center for Atmospheric Research, with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Air Force Weather Agency, and the Naval Research Lab. Those models are much more complicated than Schilling's, but the basic idea is the same: a set of principles that take us from input to output. In prediction, we know our input conditions and are fairly confident of our mechanism. We read the new information we're after as the output, at the output stage, an estimate of what the weather's going to be like tomorrow. If we use an X for information we have, and an O for the information we're trying to get, the case of prediction looks like this. Prediction is one thing the three-stage structure of models is good for. But sometimes what we want to know is not what's going to happen in the future, but what happened in the past. We want not prediction, but postdiction or retrodiction. Here's an example. There is still a great deal of debate as to how the moon was formed. One theory is that the centrifugal force of the spinning Earth ejected it as a chunk early in the history of the solar system. There's another theory that the moon was a separate body captured in the Earth's gravitational field. According to a third theory, the moon was formed when some other large body hit the early Earth, blasting out material that became the moon. How do we decide between those theories? How do we figure out what happened? Here's one way: build a model. We build into our mechanism a representation of physical laws. Centrifugal force relative to rotation, the physics of velocity and impact, and gravity. We take that mechanism as given. We also take the output as given, a moon rotating the Earth in the way we know it does, with the composition we know it has. The question for the model is now, take what the theories say happened as input. Will that hypothesized input produce that output with that mechanism? Could the early Earth have rotated in such a way as to eject the moon as a chunk? Could the Earth have captured another body in its gravitational field? Could the moon have been formed by a collision with another body? If any of those inputs produces our given output with the mechanism of natural law, we have a point in favor of that particular theory. If we can't get the model to work with a particular input, we have a point against it. In prediction, we put in input and mechanism and read off the information we're after as the output. In retrodiction, we assume mechanism and output and read off the information we're after from what inputs produce that output with that mechanism. So we have two different ways of using the three-part structure of models. Put next to each other, they look like this. In this case, by the way, contemporary computer models favor the third theory. Given the mechanisms of physical law, a giant impact in the early solar system is that input that does best at producing an output that matches the size, orbit, and composition of the moon. Schelling's model uses the three-part structure in a third way. He isn't after a prediction. He isn't after a retrodiction. What he wants is an explanation. What mechanism might take us from just about any input, a fairly random one, for example, to the patterns of residential segregation we see around us? In Schelling's case, we assume an input, observe an output, and ask what mechanism would take us from one to the other. Put beside the others, the structure of explanation looks like this. Models quite standardly come with those three stages, input, mechanism, and output. But we can get three different cognitive payoffs by using that three-part structure in different ways. We may be looking for new information in model output, that's prediction. We may be considering what happens with different inputs, that's what we want for retrodiction. We may be looking for mechanisms that take us from input to output, that's what explanation is all about. Thinking with models is a great tool, but it's also a risky one, with important limitations. It's important to keep those in mind when evaluating the information that models give us. Thinking with models is a way of thinking through if-then connections in the real world. We're trying to understand something real, what the weather is going to be like, how the moon was formed, or what it is that accounts for persistent residential segregation. In order to be useful, models have to be simpler than the reality that we're going to understand. But they also have to match reality in the relevant ways. If we want a reliable prediction of tomorrow's weather, our inputs have to be right. Our mechanisms have to work the way the weather really does. That's a challenge that meteorologists have been dealing with in computer models for years. The case of retrodiction is perhaps even more challenging. We can probably rely on our observations of the moon, but here too we have to be confident that our mechanism captures the relevant physical laws. Another problem with retrodiction, there might be more than one set of inputs that are sufficient to produce the outcome. Put it this way, models are made to mirror an if-then connection. If a Mars-sized body collided with the early Earth, it could have thrown out a moon that matches ours in composition and orbit. But even if our model tells us that, it doesn't tell us that's the only chain of events that could have produced that outcome. It doesn't tell us this is the only input that would give us that output. The same issue shows up in explanation. The fact that a particular mechanism leads from a particular input to an observed output doesn't tell us that it's the only mechanism that could produce that outcome. It also doesn't tell us that it's the mechanism that actually produced that result in reality. Schelling was pretty careful about all of that. He only claimed that low levels of quite ordinary preference could have produced residential segregation. That is, in fact, all that a model like his can show. It can't show that low-level preference is the only thing that could have produced that result. It can't show that low-level preference is what actually produced the result. Models are all about constructing an if-then. As we saw in an earlier lecture, that's what scientific experiments are about, too. There is, in fact, a close connection between model building and experimentation. The models we've talked about so far are conceptual models, or conceptual models instantiated in computer programs. But the history of physical models shows the same three-stage structure. There, too, the three stages can be used for prediction, or retrodiction, or explanation. In 1900, Orville and Wilbur were trying to figure out how to build a flying machine. It was going to have wings, but what kind of wings would work? What kind of wings would allow controlled flight? The Wright brothers could have tried working entirely inside their skulls. Other people had, but they didn't. They were bicycle mechanics by trade. They were used to thinking with a wrench in their hands. Their thinking about wings was hands-on, too. They built a wind tunnel, 16 inches wide, 16 inches tall, and 6 feet long. It was a finicky apparatus. Wilbur said, "Occasionally I had to yell at my brother to keep him from moving, even just a little in the room, because it would disturb the airflow." The Wright brothers moved with models of miniature wings in that wind tunnel, none over 9 inches long. As Wilbur said, "It's doubtful if anyone would ever have developed a flyable wing without it." They were after an if-then. If a wing has this structure, then it'll fly like this. Over the course of several months, they tested over 200 wing designs. They wanted to be able to predict which wing designs might actually work. But remember the limitations of models. At this point, they were only working with a model. They assumed that the forces in their miniature wind tunnel would scale up to the real world. But in physical models, as in conceptual models, as in computer models, that correspondence with reality is always a risk. Wilbur says, "We finally stopped our wind tunnel experiments just before Christmas 1901. We really concluded them rather reluctantly because we had a bicycle business to run." There have been some wonderful physical models. One of my favorites is the Mississippi Basin model in Clinton, Mississippi. The 1920s and 1930s had seen devastating flooding from the Mississippi River. In the 1940s, in order to figure out what to do about it, the Army Corps of Engineers built a miniature model of the entire river basin. Begun with labor by German prisoners of war, the model covered some 200 acres. Trees were modeled with folded screen wire at a height taken from aerial photographs, and the roughness of river bottoms was modeled by scoring and brushing concrete channels in the model. 3 days on the river could be modeled in 5 minutes in the model. That model was used for a whole range of if-thens. Can we prevent flooding in New Orleans by redirecting floodwaters into the Atchafalaya Basin? Which are the levees most at risk? The model was used in real time to guide policy in 1973 in response to 77 days of flooding from St. Louis on down. A similar physical model was constructed for the San Francisco Bay in the 1950s in order to evaluate a proposal to drain portions of the bay. What would happen if we did that? The Army Corps of Engineers built physical models in searching for an explanation of why the 17th Street Canal levee gave way under the impact of Hurricane Katrina. Conceptual models have sometimes served merely as metaphors. I think this is true of Plato's image of the cave in the Republic, for example. Plato constructs a model to illustrate his theory of the relations between appearance and reality. We are like prisoners chained in a cave. We think we see reality, but all we really see are shadows cast by light coming in from the outside. But conceptual models have often served as something more in the history of philosophy, something more like Schelling's model. The philosopher Thomas Hobbes witnessed firsthand the ravages of the English Civil War that raged from 1642 to 1651. What he wanted to understand were prospects for stability and peace. You could put his question this way: given what we know of human nature as input, what mechanism would produce stable peace as an outcome? His view of human nature was of individuals out for their own interests alone. That was his input, what he called a state of nature. In a state of nature, life was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. What mechanism could lead us from that to a stable peace? Hobbes called his book Leviathan, and that was his proposal for the necessary mechanism. In order to get from the state of nature to a state of stable peace, people would have to contract together. They'd have to give up their individual liberties to a central state, to a Leviathan, more specifically, to something like a monarchy. That's thinking with a three-stage model. Like all models, it has risks. We want to know how real all three stages of the model are. Are people as egoistic as Hobbes treats them in his input condition? Would a social contract really give the desired output, or would it just result in a centralized tyranny? Even if Hobbes's social contract mechanism would produce the outcome, is it the only way to do so? The most desirable way to do so? Game theory is another instance of model thinking. It assumes players' rationality and self-interest as input. It assumes a matrix of payoffs as a mechanism. It looks to see what the outcome can be expected to be with certain structured penalties and incentives. We talked about some of the risks of that kind of model thinking in the lecture on game theory. Do people behave in the way game theory assumes? Are we really homo economicus? That's a challenge to input assumption. What exactly are the values of our interactions? Why think they're captured in the matrix for the prisoner's dilemma? That's a challenge to the mechanism assumed in game theoretic models. The take-home message is this: three-stage models are a way to put strategies of visualization and simplification to work in figuring out if-thens. It often helps to think of things in terms of simplified input, mechanism, and output, whether that structure is instantiated physically, computationally, or conceptually. If you want to predict what's going to happen, work from input and mechanism. If you want to figure out what happened in the past, figure out what inputs would give you observed outputs with known mechanisms. Explanation? Figure out what mechanism would lead from known inputs to known outputs. Learning to think in models can also take you farther. My friend Josh Epstein is a contemporary researcher who has built models intended to cast light on how diseases transfer across populations, how revolutions happen, and what may have happened to the ancient Anasazi in the American Southwest. In a piece called Why Model?, he offers a list of other things thinking in models is good for. Thinking with models offers tools for prediction, retrodiction, and explanation. But thinking in models can also be used to guide data collection, to explore the core dynamics of a process, to suggest analogies for understanding. What are other things that work this way? To illuminate core uncertainties. Where is our knowledge most vulnerable? To point up overlooked details that might make a difference, to offer options for change or intervention, to show the simple core of complex processes and the complexities behind some simple ones. Last but not least, to suggest new questions. The next lecture is our last. I'll use that for a quick review of some of what we've done in terms of lessons from the great thinkers.